We're feeling very brave about tackling today's Please Explain subject, which in part requires speaking what will be for most of us a foreign language. In fact, because of the complexity and wonder of the subject, we've invited not one or two, but three renowned physicists to help us understand matter and antimatter, the world of particle physics, and recent developments in the field, which may shed light on how it is that we exist. Joining us now are Dr. Lisa Randall, Frank B. Baird, Professor of Science at Harvard University. She studies theoretical physics, particle physics, and cosmology, and is the author of Warped Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. Also, Dr. Mordechai Mark McLow, the curator and chair of the Department of Astrophysics, Division of Physical Sciences at the American Museum of Natural History, and Dr. Michael Tutz, a professor of physics at Columbia University and operations program manager for the U.S. Atlas Project. His expertise is in experimental high-energy physics, and he joins us from Geneva, Switzerland. More about that in a moment. Dr. Randall, on these Please Explain segments, we usually begin with the simplest aspects of a subject and build toward a deeper understanding, and so far as we're able to do that in 45 minutes or so. So with that in mind, is there a good place to start in a discussion of particle physics?
Okay, so first of all, thanks for having us here. I think it might be esoteric, but it also is the reason we're here today, why there's matter and not more than antimatter. Particle physics is esoteric in the sense that it studies things that are very far from what we directly see. But what we're trying to understand is what's going on at matter's core. What is the fundamental building blocks? What are the fundamental forces? What is it that it's at the essence of matter that constitutes what we know?
So can you talk about some basic definitions? If matter and antimatter are subjects today, how do we define those terms?
So matter and antimatter are defined relative to each other. So antimatter, I guess, is considered a rather exotic concept, but actually we've known about antimatter for a while.
And for a long time, didn't we think that matter and antimatter were in equal parts?
Well, we sort of knew that wasn't true because we're here to tell the tale. So that's a real mystery.
Because we're all matter.
Yeah, we're all matter. If there was antimatter around, we would annihilate and be gone. So it's very important that there's more matter than antimatter. And it is actually one of the big mysteries we have, both for particle physics and for cosmology, how the universe evolved. But we have ideas of what it could be, but that's a big mystery. So antimatter, just to be clear, is not some exotic form of matter. It's not something with different. It's some stuff that has exactly, it's related to all the matter we know. For every matter particle we know of, there at least in principle exists an antimatter particle. In fact, we can produce them at colliders, and it annihilates with matter. That is to say, it has exactly the opposite charges, the same mass. So when it gets together with matter through E equals mc squared, it can turn into pure energy. So antimatter is the stuff that you can get together with matter and annihilate.
Dr. McLow, is dark matter part of this, or is that something totally different?
Well, we don't entirely know yet. We have ideas about what dark matter is, but all we know is that it exerts gravitational forces. And it exerts gravitational forces on the scales of galaxies and clusters of galaxies in the universe. So we know it's out there. We know it's in here. If I hold out my hands, there's dark matter passing through them. But it doesn't interact with visible matter. Regular matter, all the matter that we've just discussed, in any way that we've been able yet to detect, except by gravity. So we don't entirely know, although we have ideas.
So you say it's here, but there's no way to prove that it's here.
Not yet. There are certainly people like Elena Aprile up at Columbia who are devoting huge efforts to trying to directly detect that dark matter.
So can I just intervene for 1 second? I just want to make sure that it's clear to everyone that antimatter and dark matter are really two entirely different things. So antimatter has interactions like the matter we know of. It interacts with light, for example. Dark matter is really just something entirely new. It's really a totally different subject.
And it's only a theory at this point. But
it's more than a theory.
Yes. Well, there's actually experimental evidence for the existence of dark matter. 86%
of all matter, it's being called WIMP. Isn't it?
Weakly interacting
massive particles?
That's the current best theory for what we've got out there. It's supported by a huge number of observations of many different sorts. It's just that we can't yet characterize the dark matter as being a WIMP or something else.
Well, let's bring Dr. Tutz in here. Wasn't there an attempt to find dark matter at the near where you are right now in Switzerland?
Well, one of the possibilities is that a new set of particles that we might find that go by the name of supersymmetric particles, it's possible that one of those is the stuff of dark matter.
The WIMP.
We don't know that. We certainly haven't discovered any of those things yet, but that's one of the things we'll be looking for.
Well, you're at the Large Hadron Collider right now?
That's right. I'm calling you from Geneva, Switzerland, which is where the Large Hadron Collider is, just outside of Geneva.
And hasn't it been in the news this week? Have there been important discoveries already?
No. I think the news that you're referring to were some news that was put out by the so-called the D-Zero experiment at Fermilab. That's another accelerator that's currently running in the U.S. just outside of Chicago. And they had some interesting results that they just presented and published this week.
Neutral B mesons?
That's correct. These, it goes by a funny name, these neutral B mesons, but when Lisa was talking about the fundamental building blocks of nature, one of those fundamental building blocks goes by the name of quarks, and we think there are six of those guys. And these B mesons are made of one of those quarks together with another one. So it's a B quark or a bottom quark together with one of the other quarks, and that's what makes up a B meson, and that's one of the particles that was being looked at after many, many years of observing collisions was what was being looked at Fermilab this week.
Well, quarks go back a long time. We had Murray Gell-Mann on the show at least 20 years ago, and it was already an old concept. But how many of these things were just concepts? Is the collider intended to actually allow us to see all of these things that scientists have been theorizing?
So at the time Murray first proposed quarks, we knew about light quarks. There's quarks called up and down quarks inside the proton. But
these are all particles within what we thought was the smallest particle?
Right. So we found that inside the nucleus, there are protons and neutrons. And those protons and neutrons are not fundamental themselves, but they have quarks in them. And they're bound together through something called the strong nuclear force. And so that's really important for proton physics. But what we found is that there also are heavier quarks. And in fact, Fermilab, or the Tevatron at Fermilab, which is the accelerator that was the highest energy accelerator before the Large Hadron Collider, actually found the heaviest quark, the top quark, and also can study the second heaviest quark, which is the bottom quark, which could tell us a lot about the properties of matter.
Now, you're Dr. Tutz at the Large Hadron Collider, which is the largest in the world. Why must something that's designed to deal with the smallest particles known to us be so enormous?
Well, the key to trying to unlock these sort of these secrets and understand the fundamental forces in particles is to probe at smaller and smaller distances. And if you can kind of imagine it, right, if you wanted to look at the inside of your watch, if you're a particle physicist, you might take your watch and drop it on the floor, and it just bounces, not much happens. You want to see a little bit further inside your watch, you go up to the top of the building, you drop it, it smashes into little bits. That's essentially what we try and do in the accelerator. We take, in the case of the Large Hadron Collider, protons going around in one direction in this very large tunnel. It's 60 miles in circumference, and it's about 300 feet underground. In fact, so large it actually crosses the border between France and Switzerland. And protons go around in one direction. Protons go around in the other direction. We get them going up at almost the speed of light. And then using the equation you just heard, E equals mc squared, we basically take all of that energy that we put into those protons, and when we smash them together, we're then able to use the other side of the equation, the m part, to create new particles. And it's those particles and those collisions that we look at to try and see how nature is put together.
They're smashed, and then how do we see them?
So besides this big tunnel which houses magnets which keep the protons going around in a circle and they get a kick every time they go around, one of the things that we need to do is actually to observe these collisions. And to do that, we have what we call detectors. And these detectors are made up of huge numbers of electronics channels. So in the Atlas detector that I work on, we have 100 million channels of electronics surrounding the area where the collision occurs. And this detector is huge. It's as tall as an eight-story building and twice as long. So it's a vast, huge detector, and all of the debris that comes from that collision passes through our detector, and we're able to recognize the kinds of particles that come out. And from that, we can kind of infer and reconstruct what happened during that collision.
Now, Dr. Randall, this collider is 100 meters underground, but that's 30 feet or so? Is it important?
300 feet.
300 feet. Is it important that it be that deep?
Well, actually, the one at Fermilab is above ground, but it's nice to have it below ground because that helps in keeping the radiation away from everything. So it's
in other words, other things that might contaminate.
Out. Yeah.
Dr. Macklow, a friend reminded me when I told her that we were going to discuss the subject on our show that not long ago some people were worried that the Large Hadron Collider might create a black hole.
This was sort of one of these things that at the outer limits of theoretical possibility. You want to address this, Lisa? I think you've been closer to those calculations than I.
Yeah, so there's quite a story behind it. But basically, there is only even the possibility of these black holes if we have some sort of exotic theory involving something as exotic as extra dimensions of space. But you can work through both theoretically and also looking at observations in the sky, whether there could be a danger. So from theory, we know if we did make black holes, they should decay. We also know they were really small and they would decay right away. But we could also look into the sky and say that we've already seen the evidence that collisions of this energy are not dangerous because there's objects that exist that would no longer exist had there been black holes.
Well, also,
such as neutron stars.
Right. We also get very high-energy cosmic rays hitting the atmosphere every day at energies higher than the LHC will ever reach, and yet we're still here.
Of course, mm-hmm. They're a lot harder to study because you can't build these nice detectors where you can measure everything, but their collisions are happening.
Although my friend pointed out when I said, well, the black hole didn't occur, she said, how do you know we're not in it right now? Can you give us a bit of a sense of the history over recent decades? What have been some of the most important turning points in our understanding of all of this?
Well, one of the early ones is probably the detection of the understanding that it was dark matter in the first place. But of course, if you want to go back to matter, antimatter back in the 30s.
Well, I think one of the important things from our point of view is the understanding what's called the standard model of particle physics, actually understanding what are the basic elements of matter, what are the four forces through which they interact. And since then, we've been trying to understand other properties. We've been trying to understand more detailed properties of why there are as many particles as there are and what their masses are and why they have those forces.
And why they have mass.
And the theorizing began in the 30s?
The theorizing began 2,000, 3,000 years ago.
When somebody came up with the idea of the atom.
Exactly. But the idea of matter and antimatter, I think, was Dirac the first one to develop that?
Well, actually, it's a great story of theory really
preceding
predicting
experiment.
Something. Because he was trying to write down an equation that incorporated quantum mechanics and relativity to describe an electron. And he just couldn't write it down without having an antiparticle, called a positron. And at the time, we'd never seen it. He tried to get rid of it. He couldn't. And so it was a real vindication when they actually discovered the antiparticle.
Dr. Tetz, what can we expect? What experiments are scheduled for the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, we've started running now. We started a little bit before in December or so. And we've collected so far 500 million events of these collisions. But that's a very tiny drop in the bucket compared to what we ultimately expect to collect. And we actually need, because the processes that we're looking at are very rare. And so we need vast amounts of data. So we run 24/7, basically. Right now, they're kind of tuning up the machine, the accelerator itself, to improve the performance of it, and that's going to happen over the course of the next few months, for example. But in the meantime, we're also collecting data, and we're starting to see interesting stuff, but we still need to collect a lot more data before we would see some new, innovative, and unexpected, perhaps, physics results.
We're going to start taking calls from our listeners in just a few minutes. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be back with my guest, Michael Tutz, professor of physics at Columbia University and operations program manager for the U.S. Atlas Project. Also, Dr. Mordechai Mark MacLowe, the curator and chair of the Department of Astrophysics Division of Physical Sciences at the American Museum of Natural History, and Dr. Lisa Randall, the Frank B. Baird professor of science at Harvard University. Stay with us. We're back with Please Explain, Dr. Mordechai Mark MacLowe, chair of the Department of Physics at the American Museum of Natural History. He specializes in theoretical astrophysics, the formation of stars and planets, dark matter, and dark energy. Dr. Lisa Randall, professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University, who specializes in particle physics, identifying what things are, matter and antimatter. And I hope that I'm describing what you do correctly. Dr. Michael Tutz is talking to us by phone from Geneva. He's a professor of physics at Columbia University, and he is also operations program manager for the U.S. Atlas Project. And he measures and detects particles, matter and antimatter, and that's why he is at the Large Hadron Collider. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Just one more thing before we start taking those calls. Dr. Randall, I understand that early on you and a colleague had anticipated some of the developments that have turned up this week, the ability to detect those incredibly small particles, but that others felt it wasn't possible to imagine. Can you tell us about that?
So we knew we could detect the particles. What I worked with a student at the time, Xufeng Su, who actually reminded me that we wrote a paper in 1998, where we were saying that you can actually learn something about this matter-antimatter asymmetry and its origin by studying in very detailed way these B mesons that you mentioned earlier. But it's a really small effect. But our point was that in the standard model, that is to say if there's no new physics around, there's no new physical theory, it's such a tiny effect that you would never measure it. So if you measured anything, it would be an indication that there's something new and interesting going on. And we showed how to interpret it. The funny thing, though, is that we talked about it at the time. And she reminded me of this, too. People said, oh, we'll never do that measurement. And here we are over 10 years later with this result. And so it's pretty exciting.
Never tell an observer or an experimenter what they can't do. I learned that lesson a long time ago.
It was the other way around. We said this would be really interesting. And the experimenters told us this is a really hard measurement to do. Mm-hmm. But then they went and figured out how to do it.
And Dr. Magla, just one, because I don't think we really explained dark matter clearly enough. As I understand it, something like it's theorized it's 86%.
It's measured to be. So of all matter in the universe, dark matter is 85-86%.
And the reason we know it's there is because it has a gravitational impact?
That's exactly. It has a gravitational pull. So if you look at how galaxies rotate, they spin as if they were much heavier objects than all the stars and gas that we can see in them would indicate. If we look at how galaxies rotate around each other in clusters of galaxies, they move much faster than they would if the galaxies themselves and the gas that we see were all the matter. So there must be some other sort of matter that we can't detect other than by its gravitational pull, and that's what we call dark matter.
Dr. Tutz, you talked about how the Large Hadron Collider is gearing up. It hasn't been gearing up for a long time. Why is it taking so long to get the operation going?
Well, there are two things. One is that we did start about a year ago, a little over a year ago, and then there was an unfortunate accident in which one of the magnets was destroyed, and it took a long time, actually, to effect the repairs on that. So that was done at the end of 2009, and then we turned on. And we're now running at about half the ultimate energy that we're going to have, but already we're at 3.5 times the energy that, for example, the Fermilab accelerator produces. So we're in a new regime. We're exploring new territory already. It's just that it's a very complicated machine. It's got, you know, 1,200 magnets running at superconducting temperatures. This detector that I told you about have hundreds of millions of channels. It's all very, very complicated stuff. And so to get it going and get it working up to full specifications just takes time.
Yeah, but when you finally get it going at full speed, are there things that you expect to find, or are you expecting to be surprised?
A bit of both, we hope. That is to say, there are many things that we hope and we might expect to find, and among them are things like the way we characterize it is the origin of mass. Why do these little quarks and fundamental particles have mass? How do they get their mass? And so within the standard model, there are explanations of that, and so we hope that we can actually find that particle, which is called the Higgs, if it exists. That's one of the things. We're looking for a whole, for every particle that we have, there are some theories that would tell us that there are another class of particles, supersymmetric particles, partners to all the ones that we know now. We've never seen those, so we would certainly hope that we would be able to discover those if they're there.
And I should interject at this point that the lightest of those supersymmetric particles is considered to be a very strong candidate for what the heck the dark matter might be.
So let's take some calls.
Exactly. That,
okay.
Right. And you know, then there are other things such as Lisa Randall has postulated, that, you know, maybe we will have see experimental evidence for the existence of extra dimensions. That would be pretty astonishing if we could see that.
Because they're part of our theorizing, but we have no proof that there are. String theory is based on the idea that there are lots of extra dimensions.
So. But here we're just talking about trying to explain properties of matter we know about and understanding why masses are what they are. It turns out it's a huge mystery why masses are what they are, and you need something exotic. It could be an extension of the symmetries of space-time, which is what supersymmetry is, or it could be an extension of space itself.
Should we take some calls? Our number again, 212-433-9692. John from the Lower East Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
Okay, go ahead.
Hello, professors. Just wanted to actually direct a question to Dr. Randall. Girls today really aren't being, I guess, you know, they're not being developed so that they can get into the sciences, or they're not being guided because, I guess, the way we, you know, our society is. And I was just wondering how... If Dr. Randall had any ideas how we can excite them and bring them along so that it's okay for them to study math and science and maybe go into careers, into even engineering. It doesn't have to go as exotic as theoretical physics, and I just was wondering if you had an opinion on that.
Well, that's probably a more difficult question than particle physics, but I do think that there's something to be said just for really exposing people. I think we have this idea that people aren't interested or that it's difficult, but I think once people learn about some of these ideas, once they start being able to solve the problems themselves, people get excited. And I think there's something about just making the science accessible. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I decided to write a book, not just for girls, but for everyone, so that people could know what's going on and understand what's at the root of it all.
Here's another caller, Mike from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Simple question that I just never could explain. If, you know, understanding the Big Bang theory, the universe is supposed to have began from a singularity and expanded from that, the universe is continually expanding, then why wouldn't the universe be expanding on the subatomic level as well?
It's all of space-time is expanding. However, anything that's held together by stronger forces, even gravity or certainly electromagnetic forces, space-time slips out from underneath. Subatomic particles, of course, are held together by very strong forces, the weak and strong force. And so they are bound together. But even galaxies are bound together so that space-time slips out, even clusters of galaxies. You can only really see the expansion of the universe if you look at the very largest scales where even gravity becomes ineffective.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. Mark Goering has written in. He asks, what is a Higgs field, and why would the observation of a Higgs boson confirm the existence of one? Another listener, Rena from Queens, asks, what is exactly is the God particle, and how did it get that name? I suspect those are related questions, aren't they, Dr. Tutz?
The Kahn particle was there was a book written by Leon Lederman, and I think at least the title makes it so that you sell more copies. But the God particle was referring to the Higgs particle, and in this notion of the standard model of explaining how particles acquire their mass, is the notion that filling all of space is something that we call the Higgs field, and it's the interaction of those fundamental particles with that Higgs field which gives rise to their mass. But kind of the, if you kind of think of it as the oscillation of the field itself, that is what we would call the Higgs particle.
And we have not yet seen it. This is something you're hoping to find through the work on the collider.
We haven't seen it, although Fermilab, the experiments at Fermilab at the Tetratron have becoming sensitive enough to rule out particular regions, because what we don't know is what the mass of this Higgs particle is. But they're able to start to rule out some particular regions, and so we're starting to narrow down and bear down on this. And at the LHC, we certainly expect we have enough energy and we'll have enough collisions to actually be able to definitively answer this question.
Peter on Facebook asks, might dark matter energy be the remnants of the original early mass annihilation antimatter shortly after the Big Bang?
Well, actually, one of the ways that we think about dark matter, which we mentioned the supersymmetric candidate, but that's actually one of the ways we can figure out if there is dark matter. You start off with matter and antimatter, and it can annihilate, but there might be some left over. So if you have a particle that's actually stable, that is to say it doesn't decay, and it turns out that if it has essentially the mass that is being explored at the Large Hadron Collider and even at the Tevatron, it actually has exactly the properties that it would have the right, what we call relic abundance, the right amount left today to actually constitute the dark matter.
We go now to Rich from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have actually lots of questions, but I'll try and limit it to two, if I may. One is
limited to one.
All right. Virtual particles, is it true matter can be created out of nothing?
Yes, in a matter of speaking. The problem is that whenever you create a virtual particle, you also create its virtual antiparticle. And except under rather extreme circumstances, like being at the edge of a black hole, that virtual particle and virtual antiparticle meet each other and annihilate.
Actually, though, at a collider, though, one of the really exciting things is that matter can meet antimatter and create something which then becomes particles and antiparticles that we can detect because they fly away from each other. So that's actually one of the things that we're looking for, are matter and antimatter. They're not created from nothing. They're created from energy.
So matter and antimatter work almost like magnetic poles? They fly away from each other?
Well, they have... That's determined by the kinematics, but the fact is that they have opposite charge, matter and antimatter, because you have to have no charge left over when they get together. So they have opposite charges.
They fly away from each other because you've just smashed some particles together, and there's a lot of things flying around.
You have to conserve energy moment.
Stephen from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I love your show, and I love this particular section. I have one major question, and that is, can you explain why the speed of light cannot be exceeded?
Except on Star Trek.
The amazing thing is we actually don't have, that's actually a fundamental postulate in some sense of special relativity of Einstein's theory. It certainly seems that everything agrees with that, and if the symmetries of space-time are what they are, we cannot exceed the speed of light. But it's actually an assumption in some sense.
Or in some sense, why the space-time should have the symmetry it does is something we observe, we see it, but why the universe is this way rather than that way still is kind of almost a question of philosophy.
And from a practical point of view, you know, as an experimental particle physicist, for example, we get our protons going faster and faster, but it takes more and more energy as you get closer and closer to the speed of light. So in some sense, it would take an infinite amount of energy to get them going up at that speed. So they never quite reach it.
But we could get very close to the speed of light.
And almost as
arbitrarily, if you want to put enough energy in.
Right.
Let's take another call. We go now to Ramaswamy from Closter, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I would like to ask the guests to explain in layman's terms how a set of equations can explain various things. Like they speak of the standard model, they speak of various other subatomic theories. I do understand how, given the truth of Newton's laws, you can explain using mathematics how planets move or how eclipses can be predicted and those kinds of things. But I fail to understand how you can write a set of equations and say that a set of equations can be manufactured out of thin air, so to speak. For example, electromagnetic theory.
So none of the equations are really
standard model and things of that nature.
So the equations aren't being manufactured out of thin air. The way science works is that there's a collaboration between theory and experiment in general. There's a bunch of data, and you put it together and try to figure out which equations can explain everything that's been seen so far. If those equations work to explain what's been seen before, then you might trust them to predict what can happen next. And if you find a violation, well, then you've learned something. And so that's the way we build up. We have the standard model because we observed all the particles. In fact, particles like there's a heavier copy of the electron called the muon. When that was discovered, the response of one of the physicists I interviewed was, "Who ordered that?" I mean, no one predicted that particle to be there, but it was there. So once we know these are there, then they're part of the equations that we set up, and then we try to figure out what the other consequences would be.
But, for example, in string theory, there are a lot of people coming up with different equations and different approaches. In the end, experiments are going to have to prove whether one of those equations is the correct one or if any of them are the correct one.
Well, that's one part. But they also have to be mathematically consistent.
So string theory right now, you're correct, is very distant from what experiments can test. What string theory can provide are sort of ideas like the idea about extra dimensions or these objects called brains. There's just objects that exist within string theory that we could perhaps test whether those things happen. But to test string theory itself, unfortunately, is probably far from the possibility with experiment. But it's not completely disconnected in the sense that there are some elements of string theory that we might test.
Dr. Tutz, could we test some elements of string theory with the Hadron Collider?
Well, for example, these, as was mentioned, things such as extra dimensions, which are perhaps inspired from string theories, there are predictions that our, you know, theoretical colleagues make that we can then look for and that are actually accessible, hopefully, at the Large Hadron Collider. So, yeah, if we're lucky, we'll be able to test some of those things.
And we go now to Bob from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air. Bob, can you make it quick?
Wanted to ask: when an antiparticle annihilates its positive counterpart, is that simply it's explained as charge being the reason that it annihilates? But is there not a more sophisticated explanation than that? I mean, if you throw enough electrons at a proton, I don't think that annihilates the proton. Is there a more detailed explanation than simply that their charges are different?
Yeah, I mean, there's a theoretical description of what an antiparticle is, and it's not just any particle. It's a particle that has the same mass as the particle, we know that there is an interaction between a particle and antiparticle, and say if it has some force that it carries, it can turn into the particle carrying that force. So there are very definite interactions that, when we put together quantum mechanics and relativity, we know should occur.
We have very little more time, but a number of people have asked for suggestions of books, of course yours, Lisa, but other books for people who took high school physics and are want to know more about this but are totally confounded. There are some pretty basic books out there.
Well, I'm actually going to be speaking at the New York Academy of Sciences along with Michael Tutz about a pop-up book, which I actually haven't seen yet. I'm actually writing another book that will be more basic and explain some of these ideas that will come out in over a year.
But meanwhile, we have warp passages unraveling the mysteries of the universe's hidden dimensions. Are there any books that you like?
So, like Lisa said, right, it's hard to believe, but we have a pop-up book about our experiment. You open it up and you can actually kind of build the experiment, see what's there. So it actually is sort of...
But for those who want more details, I'll write another one.
And just right. One more question, and this is a question that you often hear in these kinds of discussions. Anne from the Upper West Side asks, is there any practical application for this research?
So people always ask this question, but you could ask, when they discovered electricity, was there any practical application? And of course, we know there is, but at the time, no one knew what it was. I think there's just many side benefits. We'll learn a lot just from developing the magnets, from developing the technology to understand the information. But in terms of the actual science, we don't know yet, but that's okay.
But we also do know that the question of where we all come from, where we're all going, is one that's always fascinated people.
Because we couldn't explain what happened at the Big Bang, theoretically.
Happened for the subsequent evolution of the universe, yes.
Dr. Lisa Randall and Dr. Michael Tutz will be part of a panel discussion moderated by Alan Alda on Tuesday, May 25th at 6:30 at the New York Academy of Sciences. That's at 250 Greenwich Street. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. You wanted to add something, Dr. Tutz?
Well, I was just going to say that, for example, when your listeners type http://, right, in their browser, that protocol, Hypertext Transfer Protocol, www, was developed here at CERN and was in part developed to allow physicists to communicate across, you know, countries and nations between each other. So, you know, that's kind of spin-off developments that you might see.
And I want to thank you all so much for being with us on Please Explain Today. Dr. Michael Tutz, professor of physics at Columbia University, Dr. Lisa Randall, professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University, and Mordecai Mark MacLowe, the chair of the Department of Physics at the American Museum of Natural History. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.